You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Go Wild. Go Wild is one of the fastest growing social media applications that there is, dedicated to outdoor enthusiasts. This app is basically a community of all like-minded individuals who love Mother Nature, love to be outside, love hunting, fishing, camping, all the activities that people love to do outside. You're going to find a community for those activities within Go Wild. Now, you can download the app directly to your mobile device, your phone, and you can find that at the Google Play Store. That's where I download all my apps. Or for more information, you can go to timetogowild.com. Read up on the app, read what it's all about, lots of detail on their website. So get outside. It's time to go wild.
Welcome to the For Love of the Land podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
Each week, we're interviewing guests from across America. They all have one thing in common. They all are tied to the land. So if you're like us and you love all things land, welcome home. All right, guys. Welcome to another For Love of the Land podcast. I'm your host, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
We are cruising down the road.
Man, no,
headed to
cruising.
Another consult, or a bunch of consults, actually. We're going to hit Ohio, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Indiana. And there's multiples in Pennsylvania and multiples in Ohio. And so we are on a marathon mission of improving habitat across the country.
We're taking this thing eastbound. Eastbound and down.
We're going global.
Hold on. We're going global.
And so it's worldwide. Yeah. What was that stepbrother said? Something worldwide.
I don't know. Who knows with that movie?
Yeah, no doubt. So anyway, this is a awesome podcast coming up, and I really, really hope you guys enjoy it.
Lindsay Thomas.
It's you, basically you. It's really awesome, and yeah. I ain't even there. So that's saying
something,
right?
You about it. Yeah. After we recorded,
it sounded awesome.
Yeah, it sounded awesome, and it truly is. So take a 30-40 minutes to sit down with Lindsay Thomas of QDMA, and those who don't know of Lindsay, I'm not going to get into the story or anything, but he takes land management and land ownership to a new level, and he goes just beyond, way beyond being, if you will, put into a box of QDMA just focused on deer. And he goes into super in-depth stories of his family's property. And I think it's so intriguing because it's a unique place. So
I'm excited to sit down and listen to the whole thing because, you know, QDMA guys, we've had multiple QDMA guys on.
Yep.
But every time they come on, we pretty much talk deer or QDMA events or all things habitat but focused on deer.
Or CWD.
Or CWD. And this is a chance. And I hope it was a breath of fresh air for him because it kind of was like, oh, it's something I don't get to talk about a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
And for every one of us, what's more exciting as a land guide to do than just talk about your own piece of ground. So hopefully we broke that mold and Lindsay got to talk about
the mold.
There you go.
He crushed it.
And so really cool. If you aren't aware what QDMA is, go check it out. Quality Deer Management Association. Become a member. Help fight the fight of conservation and improving
habitat for everything,
but also supporting an organization who is doing their best to be a voice for hunters and habitat enthusiasts. So go check out QDMA at QDMA.com, I believe.
That's it.
And another announcement, we are going to be at the Gun and Gin Show in Memphis, Tennessee, March 1st and 2nd.
Yep.
We're going to be at the Ark of the Ozarks Quest Hunt Co. Hunting and Fishing Expo, February 8th and 9th in Springfield, Missouri. And presenting on the 9th. And we're going to have a booth there, so come and see us if you're in southern Missouri or anywhere close to there. Come and see us if you're anywhere near Memphis at the Gun and Gin Show. And then also we'll be at National Wild Turkey Federation Convention February 14th, 15th, 16th in Nashville, Tennessee at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel and Resort. And we will be having an after-hours seminar party at Saturday night.
Bayou Room C at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel. So if you're at the convention, you don't have to go anywhere, 6 o'clock. Check out that room. We'll be there.
Food, drinks, I think something will be there. We'll be there at least, right?
We'll be there. Pure Air will be there. Probably a couple guys from Stratton will be there. But talking a brand new seminar we've never presented on, and then doing a live Q&A podcast with everyone. So great place to hang out and chill and get to know everyone.
And so anyway, with that being said, are you ready to let them have it?
Let them have it.
All right.
All righty. Lindsay, are you there?
Hey, Matt. I'm here. How are you this morning?
I am doing all right. We were just talking there pre-podcast recording just how cold it is right now, but then what we have to look forward to in the next couple of weeks with the colds. How's Georgia?
Yeah, we are down in the I think we were in the 20s this morning. It's going to be 20s again tomorrow, so that's pretty cold here. Yeah, we're going to be down in mid-20s tomorrow. I'm looking at the forecast right now. And that's we've only had a couple of spells so far this year of 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty cold for us here, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And you live more central Georgia, is that correct?
Yeah, I live in just outside of Athens, Georgia, where QDMA's national headquarters is. And Athens is sort of northeast Georgia, really, just about an hour east of Atlanta.
Right. Fantastic. Well, if you will, that was a great, great intro. You know, talk to us a little bit about who Lindsay Thomas is, what you do for a living, and then we'll jump in kind of to the meat of the podcast and discuss Grace Acre. So, Lindsay, what do you do for a living?
I am Director of Communications for QDMA, the Quality Deer Management Association. And for anybody who doesn't know, we're a nonprofit whitetail conservation organization. I've been with QDMA for over 15 years now, and in my role, I am editor of the magazine, and my communications team here helps. We do the magazine, we do QDMA's website, we do email and social media, so all of the printed materials as well for the organization, support materials for all of our different departments are produced by my team, so that's me.
Fantastic. So how long have you been with that organization?
Just over 15 years. It was 15 back in September.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So annually, I know you guys, and we discussed on the Habitat podcast quite a bit with QDMA and kind of how we team up on some things, but you know, just quick brief rundown of the, for people who may not know what QDMA is and listening to this podcast, what are the goals that you guys have, the mission goals for QDMA?
Well, our mission is ensuring the future of whitetail deer, wildlife habitat, and our hunting heritage in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. But, you know, currently several of our specific mission goals have to do with hunter recruitment. Specifically, we're really working in the area of adult hunter recruitment. We've got a dynamic program going now, Field to Fork, that reaches out to adults from non-traditional backgrounds. In other words, they didn't grow up hunting, and helping them understand, you know, how through hunting they can acquire their own food.
Right.
So that's our big hunter recruitment push. We are, through our volunteers, working for habitat improvement on public hunting lands.
Awesome.
One of our positions is that before we decide we need more public hunting land, we think there's a lot of existing public hunting land out there that could be more productive if it was managed better. So, you know, we're pushing to get to improve habitat improvement on land that we own, public hunting land that's already in existence. We are, you know, deer research is another thing we put a lot of effort into. And these days, of course, one of the big threats we're dealing with is chronic wasting disease. So QDMA spends a lot of time working on that. So there's a, meanwhile, of course, advocacy effort. We work on policy. Kip Adams and his conservation team deal with legislation, both good for deer and bad for deer, all year long. So we're always working for deer and deer hunting. Mm-hmm. And that's wild deer. I would be very specific about that.
Sure.
We're a wild deer organization. And, you know, in the background, while we are working on the future of deer hunting, we are a strongly educational organization and Absolutely. Try to help deer hunters learn more about the whitetail, more about how to manage a deer population to improve your deer hunting, and how to improve deer habitat. So, yeah, we there's a lot going on in QEMA.
It definitely is.
Yeah, we're a nonprofit, so I would just go ahead and throw in there that we can use everybody's support to get mm-hmm. this done. So if what I just said sounds like something your listeners could get behind, you know, I'd urge them to become a member today. We are a very effective nonprofit. We are a 4-star charity as rated by Charity Navigator, which is an independent group that lets you know that the nonprofits you support use your money efficiently. So check us out there if you have any doubt, but we'd appreciate any support of your members.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. I mean, there's no doubt that you guys are in it. Everything goes beyond, as we're going to talk about later on the podcast, everything that's, you know, within land, that just that realm of land, it all kind of works together. So when you guys are talking about, you know, improving land for deer, you're improving it for so many other species, and just having management on the land is so important to redirect and get ecosystems, habitat, vegetation as productive as possible. So it's not just deer. There's a lot of other added benefits with what you guys are doing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And each one of us, you know, once you get to know many of the team members and myself, you come to realize that we are into all of that. We mm-hmm. love deer and we love deer hunting, but we've come to see the value and benefits that extend far beyond that, whether it is other game species and other non-game species and forests and plants and ecosystems. And it's just sort of once you start down that path of managing deer, the rest just falls into place, and you realize the benefits that go beyond just what you're doing for deer.
No question. And that honestly is a perfect segue into what we want to talk about a lot today, because of course we have a personal relationship, business relationship, but what I love about what you do is following along on your Instagram page, and because you oftentimes put up images and pictures and just really cool findings about your property or family's property called Grace Acres in Southeast Georgia coastal property. And it's such a unique place and not that much exposure, because there's not many coastal properties out there like this. It just doesn't get much exposure. And when you're out there, you're taking pictures of flowers, you're taking pictures of history, you're helping document what's going on the property now in comparison to way back when. And that is so intriguing to me, because, you know, you're educating people at the same time, you're captivating them, you're sharing these stories, and that's what this podcast is about. So it's a perfect fit to have you on and discuss that. So, you know, what is Grace Acres to you and your family?
It's home. It is home to our family, and home. It was home to me. That's where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And so we see it as home. But beyond that, our family goes back generations in this area. And so, you know, there's a strong pull there in that region for us. You know, in our blood, I guess mm-hmm. I would say, you know, many of our family members are there in the cemeteries in this area. It goes back generations. And so that's what this part of the country is to us, is home. And I think what I've come to realize about that is there, you know, if you're setting out to buy yourself a great deer property, lots of areas of the country come to mind. Almost no one is going to think of coastal plain Georgia when sure. they're looking for a great deer property.
Right.
But, you know, home and roots that we have there pulls at, you know, my interests mm-hmm. In a way that overpowers those sorts of things. Can you find more scenic parts of the country? Absolutely. So, you know, all of those things sort of get trumped ultimately by the fact that I'm just drawn back to this place again and again by the family ties and the roots that are there, family who are alive today and family who are gone. Mm-hmm. So it's that's a very powerful pull. And so when you ask me, what is Grace Acres, I guess that's the first word that comes to my mind, is it's my home.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is fantastic. And that's why we love land so much, because it's so dynamic. It changes, you know, at different times in your life. I'm sure that Grace Acres meant different things to you. But now, it's home, and that's where you just feel tied to. You could have other opportunities elsewhere to go hunt, you know, great monster deer in Illinois, Iowa, whatever. But, you know, doing it there and having that connection with the land is so, so important. Again, that's what draws us all into working the land, being on the land, having some sort of relationship with a property. It pulls you in every single time without fail.
Yeah, and even you don't really even have to have like what we're fortunate to have there, where there's this deep family connection. Mm-hmm. Once to me, because I've come to experience this with other properties mm-hmm. that I've been involved with as an adult, where I didn't grow up, where once you start getting your hands dirty there and you start improving things, planting things, seeing things grow, seeing things change as a result of your efforts, that same connection begins to develop
very easily. That's a great point. All right, it doesn't have to be, you know, steep with family history. You know, it can just be a brand new property that you either purchased and you just begin working, and that connection of calling it your own is powerful.
Yes.
So Grace Acres, how many acres is it? What is it kind of from a land perspective, what is it comprised of?
Well, it's right now today Grace Acres is about 550 to 600 acres. Mm-hmm. In there. It is right on the city limits of Scriven, Georgia, so we're right there in a little small farm community. Cool. Where I grew up. When I grew up, it was a farm. Dad was mm-hmm. you know, a farmer, and we grew tobacco, soybeans, corn, sometimes peanuts, and sometimes other crops.
People didn't know tobacco in the South, the Deep South, has an A at the end of it. You said tobacco.
That's right. It's tobacco. And sometimes people don't even use the T. Some people, it's just backa.
That's exactly right. Oh, that's funny. That's more like the Gulf Shores of Alabama, Georgia, down there when it gets real deep South. It's just backa.
Yep, out in the back of patch.
That's
so
funny.
But yeah, I so you know, even as a kid, I helped in the tobacco patch in the summer, and when I was out of school, and myself and my brother Rans, you know, grew up doing that. So Dad was a farmer, but you know, since then, in the years since, Dad has gradually converted it to a wildlife and tree farm, and mm-hmm. and the fields, what used to be in agriculture, 150 to 200 acres of that is now in longleaf pine.
Wow, cool.
So we are gradually converting it to sort of a native mm-hmm. habitat and wildlife property for us to enjoy, to, you know, for wildlife conservation and for hunting.
Sure.
So that's what it is today. Now it goes back, it's been in the family quite a long time, since just after the Civil War. Mm. And my dad, his uncle Lindsey Grace, was the one who gave him Grace Acres. And at one time, Lindsey Grace was he made his living in the naval stores industry.
Okay.
And what that is where they used to collect pine rosin mm-hmm. from longleaf and slash pine trees, and they called it the naval stores industry literally because most of those products went to waterproofing wooden ships.
Yeah.
So naval as in Navy. And that's where he made most of his living. He was very successful at it. At one time, I think he owned over 15,000 acres in Wayne County, Georgia.
Wow.
And ultimately, later in his life, he began giving a lot of that away. He gave a good bit to the county. There's a Lake Grace there in Wayne County that's named after him because he gave the land for that. He gave land to community centers in some of the towns there. And then left much of the land to many of his heirs. Mm-hmm. And Dad, among the heirs, ended up getting the farm there just outside Scriven. So, again, that's, you know, where I grew up and where he made his living farming. And Uncle Lindsay, as we called him, which of course that's where the name came from. That's sure. My dad was named after Lindsay Grace, and I was named after my dad. But he got the land from his grandfather, C.C. Grace, who first bought the farm and started his own farm there just after returning from the Civil War. Wow. And he built a home there in the late 1860s. That home is still there. That's where I grew up, is in what we call the captain's house there at Grace Acres. So that's sort of the quick history there. The farm has changed over the years. At you know, like I said, Uncle Lindsay was maintaining it for collecting pine sap and rosin. So it was a different sort of forest management then. He wanted pine trees. He didn't want much in the way of live oaks or other oak species. So sure. Gradually, we sort of returned it back from that and are restoring some of the species that really should be there. But you can still go out on the farm and find some of the old history going back to, you know, the naval stores industry. It's sort of neat to walk around and see it.
That was one of those things. I'd never seen that. And you posted about that on the Instagram. And I was like, that's fascinating. And those trees, you know, that history is kind of everywhere. There's several pictures. I'm sure that was, it probably wasn't even half of them, that you can still see the remnants of the way people used the land and worked the land way back then.
They would scrape the way they collected the rosin. They would scrape the side of these large pine trees into what was called a cat face, mm-hmm. because the V-shaped grooves that they cut in the wood running down the bottom of the trunk of the tree ended up sort of being in the shape of a cat face with ears, pointed ears at the top and a nose at the bottom. But the intent of that was to funnel the mm-hmm. sap as it drained down into the base of a container of some kind. And
right.
you go back 120 years or so, and what they were doing was literally chopping a reservoir in the base of the tree to collect the rosin, and then they'd come around and dip that out. Well, that was pretty stressful on these pine trees,
yeah.
and it many times killed the tree or invited pine beetles and other problems. So around 1900 or so, a guy named Hurdy, who was a professor of forestry here at the University of Georgia, and he actually was, I believe, the first football coach of the UGA football team.
Huh.
But he was a professor of forestry, and he invented what was called the Hurdy Cup, and it's a clay-fired round cup that had a hole in it that you could hang on a nail at the base of this cat face, and all the sap would drain into that cup. You just come around, you take right. the cup off the tree, pour it into your buckets, and collect the sap that way. And you know, that was one of the things I posted pictures of, was
right.
not only can you find these old cat faces around the farm, but you can occasionally find these old clay Hurdy cups laying around, yeah. some of them broken, some of them whole, but they are true antiques. And, but yeah, it's neat to see these, you know, when you did that, when you scraped the faces of these pine trees like that, and the rosin really became saturated in the wood right there, what you ended up with was fat lighter wood.
Uh-huh.
And that, of course, doesn't rot easy, and these faces are still out there. So the men that carved these faces are long gone, but
right.
their work is still there, you know, throughout the woods.
Mm. That's incredible. I mean, we all, way back, I'm gonna keep saying way back when, but like, you know, throughout history, we've all been dependent upon the land, you know, to some degree. And again, I had never heard of people utilizing land and resources on the land, you know, for that purpose. You hear of, you know, people tapping into maple trees and stuff to make syrup, but this is completely different, a similar process, it sounds like, but for a different product and different uses. And kind of it's funny, wherever you go regionally, there's those things that, if you will, it's like a niche within that region that's just very specific to the region. And I'm, educate me, where else can you find this type of tapping in, you know, with those Hurdy pots and things for that resin? I'm sure it could probably be anywhere throughout the South, in the longleaf, or the slash pines, but was it necessary there because of it being coastal?
You know, my understanding is that it is sort of a coastal plain thing. So it
okay.
goes throughout the Southeast up into South Carolina, North Carolina, and out toward Texas. I think it was, you know, an industry that And that's a good question. I don't know whether it was related to the range of slash and longleaf pine, which mm-hmm. were sort of the top species for that, or whether it was related to, like you said, being coastal.
Right.
But that's a good question. But yeah, it is very, it was very much like you said, a syrup deal, where in the north they make maple syrup and things like that, but they would collect all this rosin and take it and boil it down in big boilers, mm-hmm. And yeah, refine it into turpentine and other products. So yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure, you know, exactly how to explain why it was a southeast coastal thing, but it, sure. it certainly is. Yeah.
That's fascinating. So what other things has Grace Acres been used for in the past? How else have people lived off the land besides the farming and utilizing the slash pine?
Well, at times they've, I know that there were some cattle on it. I believe that C.C. Grace ran cattle in addition to farming, and then those cattle remained out there for, you know, even when Uncle Lindsay owned it. They were gone by the time we lived on the farm. So farming, cattle, timber, and then hunting. And that goes all the way back to Captain Grace, who was a prolific hunter and taught his grandson, Lindsay, to hunt. And ultimately, Lindsay Grace and my Aunt Mary, they never had children of their own. Mm-hmm. And so it ended up being that Dad kind of was like a son to them.
Yeah.
And Dad, his father did not hunt, but Uncle Lindsay did.
Right.
That's where he became a hunter, was with him. So,
awesome.
And we've actually got, Dad in his gun closet has got Captain Grace's shotgun.
Oh, wow.
And I forget what model it is, but Uncle Lindsay told my dad that Captain Grace was a really good quail hunter, that often, and they would hunt wild quail there on the farm,
yep.
and that he had seen him with his own eyes bringing, you know, when the on the covey rise, yep. bringing that pump shotgun up and shooting before he actually had the shotgun to his shoulder and taking birds down, literally.
It's completely instinctual.
Yeah, beginning wow. to almost shoot from the hip with the first shot before he got the second
oh,
shot
wow.
to his shoulder and aiming and hitting birds with that first shot.
Jeez.
So they were and Uncle Lindsay came on and was a prolific quail hunter. He ultimately became a big deer hunter as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that just sort of hunting runs through the whole story of Grace Acres. And now when Uncle Lindsay, and even when my dad was growing up and learning to hunt, the other tradition that we have there in this part of the country is dog hunting,
mm-hmm.
Running deer with dogs.
Yeah.
Much like you would hunt rabbits, where you get out ahead of the dog pack and you shoot the deer when it comes by. And that's how it was done then.
Right.
But my Uncle Lindsay was one of the first men in that part of the country who owned a high-powered rifle with a scope
yeah.
for deer hunting. He still went on the dog drives and used buckshot, you know, to hunt,
mm-hmm.
but he also began hunting, sort of stalk hunting
right.
on his own without dogs, using a high powered rifle. And it was, and again, I've actually got and have killed deer with it. I've got his Remington Pump Game Master 30-06
awesome.
that again was, you know, as Dad tells it, one of the first scope deer rifles anybody had seen in Southeast mm. Georgia. And so, yeah, I mean, deer hunting and hunting in general go, way, way back on Grace
yeah,
Acres.
Absolutely. So what's the quail population like right now on Grace Acres?
It is thin. It is, you know, we're trying to get it to come back.
Sure.
But it's tough, just like it
yeah.
is everywhere. You know, wild quail used to be very abundant there,
mm-hmm.
A long time ago, but then modern farming practices, which basically, you know, you farmed, clean farmed right up to the edge of the woods
yep.
and you got rid of the fence rows and the gaps and the
mm-hmm.
edges and the corners that used to be there with less efficient farming practices.
Yep.
That was quail habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And when the clean farming practices, the efficient farming practices came on, you know, in the last half of the last century and the more recent years, all of that went away. And it basically was woods and fields. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the habitat changes and the farming changes led to a vast reduction in that edge habitat that was so beneficial to quail and certainly deer too. But so we're trying to bring them back. Our regime now of thinning timber and using prescribed fire certainly has helped with that and restoring the longleaf pine. We're at a stage now with our longleaf where it's still not quite primo quail habitat, mm-hmm. but we're getting there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I certainly think we always had a couple of coveys around, just sure. a couple. We've never hunted them because we sort of want to, you know, foster them and, mm-hmm. and let those be there to sort of come on. And, you know, most afternoons you can hear a bobwhite whistling up around the house.
Awesome.
But yeah, it's something we want to see come back soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And the important thing is, though, you're actively managing for it. You're not just kind of hoping and wishing, sitting back, actively moving forward with trying to regain some of that habitat back and doing what you can to make sure that those numbers can at least stabilize or increase. And that's super important. Adam
yeah.
discussed with a biologist this week on another podcast quail numbers and research that they're doing, and it's absolutely fascinating, incredibly fascinating here kind of in the Midwest and looking at grazing techniques and how in you know, kind of the plains, warm season grasses, for those settings, what role cattle play, and it's incredible. So anyhow, not to get distracted by that, but love to hear that there's quail there, you're working, you're managing, trying to improve that habitat. Are there any other either, and this goes into vegetation too, rare or endangered species on the property or threatened, or just some that you're like, I don't see that very much except for in and around Grace Acres with it being kind of that coastal property. You're in a unique area. So what are some of the things that you might see there that you don't experience elsewhere in Georgia?
Yeah, well, with the longleaf pine, there's a whole suite of species that go with that ecosystem, mm-hmm. that historical ecosystem, and, you know, with that package that we're trying to restore. Quail, of course, were one of the keystone species of that kind of longleaf wiregrass plain mm-hmm. That was once existent here. But then you've got this whole other collection of species that go with that. In terms of endangered species, the gopher tortoise is one of the ones that's most well known with this sort of sandhill longleaf mm-hmm. pine habitat. We do have gopher tortoises in the area and want to see more of them.
Yeah.
Indigo snakes mm-hmm. are another one that go with that. They, if you've ever seen an indigo, it's one of the most beautiful and just mesmerizing snakes you will ever see. They are just glossy black and thick all the way through, completely harmless. Mm-hmm. They're not venomous. They are hunters of other snakes. They actually eat diamondbacks and other snakes. So, but they depend on the gopher tortoise burrows for their own habitat and where they will live.
That's so kind of, it would be like I don't mean to interrupt, but like a secondary cavity nester for birds. But in this instance, it's a snake that's a secondary hole nester, if you will, but it needs the gopher tortoise to get in there and do its thing and lay eggs and prosper.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing about the gopher tortoise. They make these long, long burrows that they live in. They go way down, 20, 30, sometimes more feet tunneling underground in the sand. And that burrow ends up being a key piece of literally the habitat for some uniquely adapted species. There's actually, I believe, a gopher frog that only reproduces and lives in those burrows. So those burrows end up being a unique habitat in their own right. And yeah, the Indio snakes use them for shelter. Diamondback rattlesnakes will shelter in those as well. Mm-hmm. And a whole bunch of other insects and reptiles that use that. So that gopher tortoise ends up being, like I said, a keystone species of this whole ecological package. And so, yeah, we want to see more of those. And, you know, bringing back the longleaf pine, one of the pictures I showed on Instagram recently was me trying to produce palmetto seedlings. Mm-hmm. And you'll hear people say, you know, a few people responded and were like, man, I can't get rid of them. And it's true that in some areas, saw palmetto is very common.
Right.
But like I said, the way the farm had been used in the past for farming and running cattle and the naval stores industry, it had been pretty much wiped out except in a few pockets. And so, you know, now that we're bringing we brought longleaf back by planting it as part of the longleaf pine initiative under CRP. Mm-hmm. And so we've got, you know, row to row longleaf out in these areas, but the understory plants, you know, weren't replanted with it. So one of my projects is to try to bring in some of those, like saw palmetto, mm-hmm. wiregrass, some of the other species that are companions of this,
yep.
of longleaf, and sprinkle those in there too. So we got those projects going.
High diversity understory. I like it.
Yep. So, you know, it's when you bring these things back and particularly what we found is longleaf is very compatible with whitetails because it's a tree that you grow in a light density. And it has, when you look up at the canopy of a longleaf pine, these long, beautiful needles, and it's a very light canopy. Sunlight yes. can come through that. Mm-hmm. And it is not a dark canopy tree. So you get a lot of sunlight on the ground. And as we all know, what that does is produce foraging cover for whitetails. So this is, you know, even though I'm talking about gopher tortoises and indigo snakes and cool things like that, in the end, trying to help these animals benefits our deer hunting, our turkey hunting, our quail hunting as well. So going back to what you said about the interconnectivity of the things we hunt with the things we don't, it's you really can't work on one without benefiting the other.
You can't. And you, this example of Grace Acres, your dedication to it, you know, calling it home, everything is a slam dunk as an illustration for that, Lindsay. You know, people may look or know you as a you know, a leader in QDMA and kind of, if you will, kind of put you in a box. But truthfully, you and I and so many other people out there love more than just whitetails. Of course we love whitetails. They're fascinating and they're incredible to hunt. But beyond whitetails, when you truly get into it and feel connected to the land and want to work the land and understand it, you're exposed to so much else. And the relationships, the way everything is intertwined is mind-boggling. And what you shared so far is a perfect example of that. To be a hunter, you don't have to just be a whitetail hunter. Or to be a farmer, you don't have to be just concerned about your crops. There's so much more that happens on the land, and if we focus just solely on that, we miss out on so much other incredible, mind-blowing phenomenons, and it's there. We just have to take the time to be able to understand it, and I don't think that we have to try and appreciate it. If we just understand it, that appreciation is there. It's just ready.
Well, and
ready
the thing
to get, go ahead.
Yeah, the thing I've noticed is that many, many hunters don't realize they're having these fringe benefits for other species. You know, they're planting food plots or thinning timber, maybe doing fire, maybe planting trees, doing some hinge cutting. You know, they're trying to feed deer and encourage deer cover. But, you know, many of them don't realize mm-hmm. they're having auxiliary benefits for a whole bunch of other species. And, you know, I've said before in my writing that, you know, you can look out there and find some pretty dire information right now from scientists who feel like on a worldwide scale, we are in a fairly significant extinction period, that a lot of species around the world are vanishing at a rather alarming pace compared right. to, you know, what should be normal as a result of human activity. But my feeling is one of the things that people aren't realizing is deer hunters are one of the groups of people who are fighting that. whether they realize it or not, that within these small properties that they are managing for deer, they are creating these little diversity zones that ultimately end up benefiting the plants, the birds, insects, reptiles, amphibians, all the whole, you know, package out there of things that are in these ecosystems that you didn't think about and weren't trying to help, and you're helping them anyway and don't know it. So I think that's something hunters should pat themselves on the back for. And I think other people should look at what hunters are doing and saying, you know, this is making a difference, that in whitetail country anyway, there's not any extinctions going on.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's a perfect point to make. My question to you is, being a writer and being someone who writes all the time, produces an incredible magazine, tons of information, have you, or you may already be doing this, but documented and writing about Grace Acres in a book or some sort of fashion to document what you're seeing and what's taking place over time?
No, I haven't. And that's, I mean, in small ways, yes. I mean, Grace Acres always finds its way into my writing and my articles because that's where I do a lot of my experimentation and, and habitat work, and the things I learned from hunting and and chasing deer many times are there. So, you know, it ends up being, you know, piecemeal documented. But no, I haven't really thought about a book. It's probably not a bad idea.
If you get there, if you begin to write one, you let me know when it's published. I'll read it. I think a lot of other people will too, when they get to understand and value what we're talking about in the podcast, when they slow down and listen and watch what's happening, when they start to manage and manipulate the land, it's way more than just seeing a buck get 10 more inches on his antlers, or you know, you see your herd density increase or your age structure even back out. It's way more than that. In writing and talking about this, hopefully we can show that and reveal that. But you're sitting on a prime example, and I think you're a great writer. I think it'd be awesome.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Matt.
Absolutely. Well, any other cool things? We got about 5 more minutes on the podcast.
Yeah.
Let
me say this. As a, you know, to your listeners who might want to own land one day or do own land, let me tell you one of the things that we have done at Grace Acres that's going to be critical for the long run, because, you know, it is costly to own land.
Sure. Yes, it is.
You can't just own land and sit there without paying taxes. Mm-hmm. And if you have activities on it, there's going to be upkeep. You're going to need equipment, particularly if you want to improve it for hunting. There's things you need to do, and those things come at a cost. So you have to have income off the land. And that's one of the balances we've had to strike at Grace Acres between things we want to do for wildlife and habitat and things that make money. And some of the things, the other big piece of advice, and this is a big part of the story of Grace Acres, is programs, cost share programs that we take advantage of from the government that help us save money. We've put about half the farm, which is the swamp, about half the farm is swamp land on Little Satilla Creek. And that is now in a permanent conservation easement with the NRCS. It's in the Wetland Reserve Program. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know you guys have talked about conservation easements before, but and we could dig into that, but the financial benefits of that are enormous.
Right.
And beyond that, being involved in it, it continues to pay dividends. The NRCS folks that help us with this have come out many times and seen things on the easement that fit programs they had in place and let us know about them. You know, 2 years ago, they came out and noticed about a 5-acre area of Chinese privet that we had been wanting to control, but didn't quite know how to get rid of that much at one time. And they had a program. And the next thing we knew, a dude showed up with a mulching machine, and in about a week, mulched all that privet, came in, sprayed it a year later when it was, you know, coming back. And this hasn't caught – this has not cost us a dime.
Yeah.
It's all part of the easement.
Absolutely.
So it's things like that, that, you know, not just the cost share, not just the tax benefits of being in an easement, but, you know, all these programs. Our longleaf pine, we planted with the, like I said, the longleaf pine initiative, mm-hmm. where for 15 years we were paid to grow those trees.
Yeah.
And people don't realize the opportunities that are out there. So they will go to their NRCS office and look at, talk to your local land trust, look at, you know, it's not for everybody, but look right. into the details, because I'll be honest with you. I work for a nonprofit organization. I'm not ever going to be a wealthy man. Mm-hmm. My brother and sister, you know, none of us are going to be wealthy people, but one day we're going to be owning this farm and having to pay for its upkeep. And so the land has got to pay for itself. And that's, you know, one of the things that we're working toward. And the longleaf, for example, is now out of the program stage, and it is not in a great habitat stage right now, because it's kind of started to canopy out. But what we're doing is raking the pine straw.
Yeah.
And longleaf pine straw brings top dollar. It is the highest quality pine straw anybody can buy, you know, down at the home store.
Yep.
And so we're raking that, and that is we're in that stage right now. We won't be in that stage forever. At some point, we will thin the longleaf and begin to turn that more into sort of the habitat we're interested in. But for right now, raking that straw brings us that income that helps us maintain and hang on to this farm, because owning land, like I said,
costs money.
For most people, it costs money, and it's tough to do. And you have to look at these programs to help ensure and protect the land, not only so that you can own and enjoy it, but future generations can. Mm-hmm. And also with the easement deal, that ensures that even if it changes hands and one day your heirs don't own the land anymore, but somebody else does, that easement goes with the land.
Exactly.
And those acres will always be protected as habitat. So I'd urge anyone who's interested in land to look into those programs. We use them big time at Grace mm-hmm. Acres, and they're a big part of that story.
No doubt. Nailed that. And I definitely second all of that was said there. And I mean, that's the thing. There's so many opportunities, and sometimes you just got to get downright creative on ways to, you know, produce an income on a property. We've had one of our clients, he didn't want a full-time job, and he kind of midlife, not crisis, but just was like, you know what, I'm taking the family farm and I'm taking it by the reins. I'm going to work my tail off. And he did all the work himself to flip this farm and create, you know, from an agricultural setting into dynamite habitat, but utilize government programs. And instead of hiring a contractor, again, he didn't have another job. He just did himself. And there was his income. But he just had to get creative and say, I got to figure this thing out. I've got land. How do I make it work? How do I help pay for it? And that was part of his process. And sometimes you got to do it, because, again, I said, that's family land. That means something. It means something to you right now. It's going to mean something to your kids. And you got to get creative. And those are great options to be able to look into. And if you're going to do that work anyhow and want those benefits, why not get a little money back from it or have it paid for?
That's right. Yeah. And the, you know, you don't have to have either income or wildlife. They can go hand in hand. And if someone 100%. Will work with someone like you, a consultant like you, a forester, or just mm-hmm. get someone professional who understands deer hunting and wildlife benefits as well, and they will help you straddle those two interests, so yes. that you're, you know, managing the timber for income or looking for other sources of income off the land, like our pine straw, that you can do in ways that mesh with your wildlife priorities. And it's very doable. You don't have to choose between, well, managing timber for income or managing land for wildlife. There are practices that allow you to achieve both.
It's a marriage between the two of them, and it's 100% possible to do both. No doubt, no question.
Yes.
That's the situation that we're in too. I mean, we have to look at, you know, what it's going to take to be able to run and operate farming. We're in the same situation, utilize those same types of programs, and it's working. So Lindsay, I really appreciate your time coming on. Extremely knowledgeable. I love the insight that you share and your perspective and the way that you utilize Grace Acres, and I hope everyone else can kind of see that passion and appreciate just as much as we do. So thank you for coming on and talking about the history. And I'm sure we probably will have a follow-up podcast on this just because I know that there's more to cover, and we'll get there. But thank you again, sir, for your time.
Man, I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely.
So we'll do this one. All right. So for this week's highlighted property, it's our very own
woohoo
listing. We just got recently here in southern Missouri, 178 acres. Near Hartville, Missouri. This is a very unique property, right on the highway, Highway 5, but it kind of has the ability to be turned into what you want it to be. If you want to be just recreational cattle farm, horse farm, maybe want goats and sheep, you have that ability. It has a house. It's very diversified. You've got bottom ground, about a 25, 26 acre bottom field. It butts up against the Woods Fork branch of the Gasconade River. So it has water frontage, and but then it's got about 30 to 35 acres of pretty cool timber, nice oak, mixed oak timber. A lot of really old oak growth, like we're talking the big wolfy trees you hear us talk about on Habitat podcasts all the time that are probably a couple hundred years old. They're scattered around, and so it's a great mix.
The cool thing is, it's like it kind of has like everything. I don't mean to like over exaggerate anything, but it truly does. Like bottom ground, check. River frontage, check. Road frontage, check. House, great house, check. Working pens, check. Pasture, check. Trees, check.
Large pond,
check. Yeah. Beautiful sunset views, truly, too. Check. And walnuts, check.
Yeah. It's a really cool property. So it's 178 acres.
If you were to think, who's going to buy that? Like, in a perfect ideal world, the way it's set up right now, what it does offer, you know, who could you see coming into something like that?
It's kind of wide open because you have the ability for a country home setting where you just buy it and you have 20 head of cows and you run them around all year long.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have the ability to, the house is centrally located, so it's off the highway, back up against the timber.
Right.
And it's a 2,800 square foot house, 4-bedroom, 3.5 bath, 2-car garage with basement, walkout basement. Lots of room in there. But since it's centrally located, you have the ability with that well to branch off and make a really high intense rotational grazing operation to where you maximize the production of it.
Put a lot more livestock on it.
Put a lot more livestock on it and have the ability to possibly, if you wanted to, it's wide open. If I owned it, I would almost consider the idea of doing maybe the bottom field in cool seasons and then leave the top and make that west kind of south facing slope pasture all in natives and then run stalkers and get some in late winter or something, send them on the cool seasons and then run them on the warm seasons, fatten them up and ship them out and kind of be out of cows and not having to feed hay during a late fall, early winter. So you have that ability. You could even, there's a big garden site by the house, so it's kind of that country home if you want to have those, that smaller herd of cows, keep them year round, maybe some horses.
To me, I look at them like that's a family setting.
It is very much.
You could, if you have the desire to want to raise a family on a farm, this would do it. Like I see kids playing down at the creek. You know, they got the trees still, but they got the farm, the livestock. They can raise their own and just really incorporate the whole family aspect into that property. So it's out in the country, but conveniences aren't far. What, it's like
8 minutes from Highway 60.
Yeah,
and so you can shoot right there. It's about an hour from Springfield, Missouri.
But a grocery store itself
is a few minutes away.
Yeah, 5 minutes away.
It's got a 30 by 50 metal barn, hay barn, pipe corral, work chute, and then it's got a 32 by 50 metal shop building with concrete floor and electricity. Really nice located house. That's located right next to the hay barn and the corral, so you kind of have that ability. There's a cattle guard keeping the cows out of the yard. That's how. Mm-hmm. So there's not constant opening gates. There's also a cattle guard at the front gate, right up the highway. So if you wanted to, you could set it up to where you never have to open a gate, but you still have cows right there. So Cool place.
Great setting.
Great setting. The pond, the owners don't know if there's still catfish in it, but a few years ago they were still catching catfish out of it. So
nice.
Pretty cool place. They're asking $600,000 for it. So
$600,000 for 178 acres, pasture, riverfront, and then a 2,800 square foot house, four bedroom, three bath.
That's right. Yeah.
Not
so
bad.
Anyway, 417-543-4486.
540-419-7547.
There you go. If you guys want more information on it, to me that you have the ability to, if you're looking for, if you're looking forward, this could be also. You ask me who's the buyer, person coming in wanting a country home setting, still with the nice ability to be right into town or right at the grocery store or kind of in the middle of the action, not too far into the middle of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that option. Or if you're a guy looking for investment property that's like, I really want to invest in something to improve it, make it as productive as possible, and then sell it later at a higher price, this farm also has that ability. Because the house is kind of, it's in great shape, but you could modernize it, fix it up a little bit more, and then turn the paddocks or the farm into more rotational grazing. So if somebody wanted to do sheep or goats and really try to maximize everything out of that farm, they could do it. So
absolutely.
Anyway,
sky's the limit. That's a good one, though. Looking forward to see kind of what
who buys it,
who buys it,
and what they do
with it. Showings, exactly.
Yeah, for sure. So anyway, guys, if you are interested in it, that something you or somebody you know is looking for, give us a shout. Okay, there you have it for Love and Land Podcast. Lindsey Thomas smashing it.
Man, he killed it. And it's so much fun talking with people about things that they don't always have the opportunity to talk. Like, he's the editor of Whitetail Magazine. And like, he talks whitetails all the time. Not that it, obviously deer are not important, but when you get him out of that element or box, you know, his mind and his knowledge is so much more vast, as he knows vegetation management. He knows the history of the property, the history of the general area, the history of wild game, and how to manage all of those in nature's image. And that's super important, and he loves doing it. It means a lot to him. It's home, and he crushed that story. I love it. He'll probably be back on.
Yep, I would say so. And that's what's so exciting about this podcast, for Love of Land Podcast, is we can talk to people who about stuff that you don't typically hear them talk about.
Yeah, exactly.
So, anyway,
well known fact, if you didn't know that about Lindsey.
Yeah.
Grace Acres.
That's right. I guess that's it. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it, and we'll catch you next week.
See ya.